is also the title of his presentation this morning, How to Be Spiritual Without Being Religious. So let's give a very warm welcome to D. Patrick Miller.
Given the title of this book and the fact that I'm in a Berkeley Unitarian Church, I think I have a converted audience. This book has a little bit of history to it, as does the other one here. It was originally published in 1995 as the Book of Practical Faith by a publisher in New York. A publisher called Hampton Roads, which is sort of based in Boston, Virginia, and here, took an interest in redoing it, and my editor Greg wanted to know what we could do for publicity. And I said, well, a big fan of the book is Janla Van Zandt, who's on the Oprah Winfrey Network. Janla used to teach this book in her institute, and he said, get me her forward, and we've got a book. So the book has a perfectly wonderful forward by Janla. I would read it, but it would just be too self-flattering. so I'll let you get to that. But my editor came up with the new title of How to Be Spiritual Without Being Religious. And my whole writing career, my whole path of development has really been about that, you know, without really intending for that to happen. sort of my life path has been this study of what is the difference of spirituality and religion. And it's a very germane topic, because despite all the influence of the evangelical right in American culture, that is a facet of social religion that is shrinking. And it's shrinking steadily. Even mainstream church going is shrinking steadily. And what's growing, a few years ago it was 30%, now it's 37% of American adults who call themselves spiritual but not religious. And this is sort of not widely reported, that the one aspect, the one part of the population that's growing in terms of spiritual religious identification is spiritual but not religious. It is not the mainstream Christian churches. It is not the evangelical right. All those populations are actually shrinking. You would just never know it if you listen to the if you listen to mainstream media. So what I'm going to do is read the introduction to this, and then give you a little preview of the book using the questions that you have out there. I'm going to open up the discussion a little bit sooner than I normally would, because it's my experience that readings that go on for 45 minutes, particularly in the morning, end up with a lot of people falling asleep. And this is also a very lively topic for people, you know, to think and talk about. And I'd rather hear more of your ideas coming back at me based on the few things I'm saying. I wanted to open with a quote that was in the original edition, but to my surprise got taken out of this edition. And I think it's particularly relevant right now with what's going on culturally and politically. And by the way, my birthday is Election Day. So you know what to do. This quote is from one of my most cherished teachers. His name is Maladoma Somé. He's an African shamanic teacher from Burkina Faso. I worked with him for like 6 weeks, 20 years ago. Wrote three magazine articles about him. One is still online, in fact. If you look up Maladoma Mother Jones on Google, you'll go straight to our interview. We did a very interesting interview for Mother Jones about African spirituality. And this is one thing that Maladoma said to me personally when we were working together, and I was talking to him about New Age spirituality. And he said, too many people jump into spirituality as a shelter to hide from reality. It doesn't work that way. The way it works is for the spirit behind you to follow you wherever you go and show you how to face up to adversity. And if there was ever a time when we need our spirit showing us how to face up to adversity in this country, it's now. So here's just the introduction, which just takes a few pages. A spiritual faith is a more practical way to deal with everyday life than cynicism, toughness, or defensiveness. And that first line comes out of my experience as an investigative reporter. Faith can be sensible and savvy, and practicing it daily increases its usefulness and reliability. Yet a spiritual faith is also tinged with mystery, for it is the connection to our unknown potential and the power of creation itself. Spirituality is the way out of misery, the way into self-knowledge, and the way toward a more fulfilling and effective life. Most people might define faith religiously as a, quote, belief in God. This book is about faith as learning to maintain a constant contact with God. By God, I mean the universal and marvelously creative energy that moves us all. By recognizing and affirming that energy, we can become increasingly peaceful and wise. Of course, belief and faith in God can coincide and strengthen each other. But I believe it is also possible to practice faith, that is, to honor, share, and benefit from a spiritual discipline, without any particular religious belief or affiliation. This is my personal experience, and it's what I mean by how to be spiritual without being religious. On the other hand, it's easy to see the damage done in the world by people promoting religious beliefs that are not backed up by the practice of a wise and tolerant faith. I won't name any names. Thus, practicing a spiritual faith is not the same as holding fast to a religious belief against all the slings and arrows of reality. In fact, faith is weakened by too much believing. Faith is the willingness to take a chance on what we do not yet believe for the sake of finding greater happiness and spreading and sharing peace. I'm convinced that what most people long for is the constant experience of spirituality and faith in their lives. Obviously, few people identify their longings that way. They're more likely to say they seek intimacy, excitement, comfort, wealth, status, or power. But these objectives are longed for because it seems they would supply what is missing in people's lives. In general terms, what people miss is a sense of stability, security, and fulfillment in everyday living. The great secret of a spiritual faith is that it can supply the core of what we long for. Faith does not replace longing, but it does refocus longing on inner qualities that can be strengthened through contemplation and practice, regardless of one's outer circumstances. By supplying the essence of what we deeply seek, faith also reduces our fear, self-absorption, and competitiveness, thus bringing about a greater harmony between people. The miracle of a well-practiced faith is that it eventually provides rewards that surpass the mere fulfillment of our desires. That's my conclusion after more than 30 years of investigating spirituality as a personal practice. I've written this book to pass on the good news of my experience, that the essence of whatever we long for in life can be attained through practicing faith. And such a practice can be undertaken by anyone with a little willingness to attempt it. Because faith may still be perceived as a vague religious ideal by some, or something like blue eyes, you're either born with or you aren't, I've tried to offer pragmatic steps toward the adoption of faith as a spiritual discipline. Near the end of the classic adventure film Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the hero faces the last and most fearful of three challenges he must surmount before he can gain entry to the chamber wherein rests the Holy Grail. Earlier, the swashbuckling, that's hard to say this early in the morning. Earlier, the swashbuckling archaeologist has been told that the search for the cup of Christ is the search for the divine within all of us. But as we know from Indy's previous adventures, inward searches are not his style. Standing before a wide, bottomless chasm, he holds a mystical map that inexplicably portrays a knight walking on air across the chasm. Comprehending that he must take a leap of faith, Indy holds his hand to his chest, blinks, gulps, and then takes a big cinematic step into the void. His foot lands on solid rock. Now, from a perspective changed only a foot or so from a moment before, he can clearly see a path that was totally camouflaged from view before his leap of faith. He crosses over and scatters glistening sand, like this, behind him to reveal the way to those who will follow. This scene is a true and accessible illustration of the nature and practicality of faith. The spiritual life requires frequent crossings from the known to the unknown. Ultimately, it can provide knowledge of our wholeness or holiness, wherein lie our real security, stability, and fulfillment. Like Indy's map, any guide to the unknown is necessarily mystical and suggestive rather than logical or definitive. And the purpose of faith is not to uphold a prior belief in something already known, but to advance our perspective on what lies ahead. Sometimes a leap of faith affords us only a few inches of progress. Yet the subtlest shifts of view can provide enormous insights and a crucial understanding of the path before us. Finally, one who has crossed over a seeming void can help illuminate the way for others who may follow. With this book, I'm trying to scatter a little bright sand on the paths across chasms that I've already traversed and encourage readers to approach the leaps of faith that are theirs to make on their own. This book recommends surrender as the route to power and inspired risk-taking as the key to security. I hope that readers will examine the path I'm describing with curiosity, skepticism, and a sense of adventure. The same qualities that have stood me in good stead in my own research and experience of spirituality. What I'm attempting to describe might also be called a spirituality of ordinary life. My experience arises from a lifelong dedication to the big questions. Who am I? Why are we here? What is the best way to be of use? I've never traveled to the East, nor surrendered myself to a guru, nor joined any religious organization to pursue these questions. Instead, I've investigated them in the midst of trying to make a living, develop healthier relationships, and deal with all the challenges and limitations of being alive on this earth. For all the problems of Western society at the present time, I feel that one of its great strengths is the opportunity it provides us to merge our dedication to democracy and free thinking with the world's great spiritual traditions, most of which have tended to be autocratic in nature. This book, like many others in recent years, is part of a nascent tradition that might be called spiritual democracy, a path of many influences, a path both practical and profound, that can be pursued by anyone in the midst of ordinary life. I hope that my perspective is accurate and compelling enough to encourage others to investigate this priceless path to happiness and wholeness as well. The rest of the book, and it is a short book, is divided into four steps to living spiritually. In the original book, that was four steps to a practical faith. And I'm going to just read those quickly, and then we're actually going to go into these steps with some discussion, if you're ready for it. The following four steps toward a personal, toward a spiritual and practical faith are both sequential and simultaneous. This kind of paradox is often experienced in the process of building faith. And one thing I want to point out here is that these four steps have to do with qualities and qualities of experience and qualities of consciousness. They're not about beliefs. Step one, releasing guilt is the removal of a common obstacle. Two, gathering trust increases strength, something akin to spiritual bodybuilding. Three, practicing patience changes one's relationship to time, replacing clock watching with a calm abiding, we hope. And step four, learning transcendence opens one's vision to more frequent and inspiring glimpses of the infinite. Now, if you turn to your hymnal, what I've done is I pulled out a quote from each of these sections with a question for reflection afterward. And that's what I'd like you to just volunteer opinions or feelings about. I'll also talk about them a little bit to help get things going.
And if you want to talk, raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone around to you.
So the first step again is releasing guilt. And I would say this is the biggest difference between conventional mainstream religions and being spiritual without being religious. It's the big dividing line. Anyone with experience in major traditions know that most of them, at least in the West, trade on guilt in one way or another. They either blackmail you into faith or scare you into faith. But you're, in one way or another, you're always a sinner, or you're always troubled, or you're always messed up. And in my experience, a spiritual practice has to do with releasing guilt. So what I say about this is, the first step toward a practical faith is the most radical. For our belief in the value of guilt is incredibly powerful. Bread in the bone, it seems. Questioning a single particle of our guilt can seem like heresy, particularly if we've been raised in a religious tradition that teaches themes of sin and guilt. Many people struggle to preserve their religious faith and their guilt at the same time, and in nearly equal proportions. This is highly impractical. Guilt takes up inner psychic space where faith could otherwise abide. Guilt and faith cannot have a peaceful coexistence. In the choice between guilt and faith lies the world's fate. For faith can conquer all. Guilt will sit on its hands and not do a damn thing. So the questions I have for this, and anyone's welcome to weigh in. What is your experience of religious guilt? How did it hurt or help your spiritual growth? And does guilt play a role in your personal spirituality today?
I think in the religious realm, you're able to release guilt. I don't see a big difference between spirituality and religion myself, because I think even the people that consider themselves spiritual but not religious, maybe their God is, like what you said, some impersonal force that we all share. And that's a very strong religious belief. So I don't think anybody's free of religious belief, personally. But then there's also spiritual practices associated with all of these religious beliefs, like in the one you're talking, in this. But then also within the biblical view of God, of a creator and creation, there's also a lot of spirituality associated with that, including the releasing of guilt with trust in God so I can be at peace. So that releases guilt also. So there's, I'm just saying that I think it's a little more muddled.
This is a personal interest to me because although I didn't grow up very religious, I was surrounded by evangelicals. This was in North Carolina, and to this day, my sister is a fiery evangelical, and she constantly tries to use guilt on me. You know, if you don't do so and so, you're not going to heaven. Or you're going to hell. And I always just repeat back to her a very true cliche. Religion is often for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for those who have been there. and that's talking about the difference in experience. One way you would release guilt is you go into that hell. You know, you don't, your personal hell of self-confrontation. You don't flee from it. Anyone else?
Yes. I have a real question about your definition of religious guilt as opposed to guilt. My personal experience is I work with murderers in San Quentin. Hmm. Guilt is a very important element in their lives. So you can reflect on that for us. Thank you.
Right. And how is it important in a sense? How do you see them using it constructively or not?
Yes, absolutely. Because you are faced in that guilt to have to deal with the question of who you are and what your relationship is in the world. And though we don't talk about it in religious terms, my own sense of it is a tremendously religious experience to go through this. I watch people come into prison broken, and I see them leaving healed.
Hmm. Would you say that guilt can be a kind of awakening?
No, it's not an awakening. It's an awareness of I have sinned. That's what guilt is to me. It's not if you do. It's like we know when we've. And when your sister says that to you, you do not have. There's no guilt associated with it.
Right.
That's not guilt.
Right.
When you do something horrible, that is guilt. And we need to reflect and grow from that. It can be a very important experience. And so, I mean, for instance, another place, it's the basis of 12-step work.
Right.
You know, to understand that I have broken, I mean, to me, the metaphor is I've broken the fabric of my community and my society, which I am also responsible for.
Right.
That's what I see the men learning out of this. So the world is not guilt-free. I mean, it's not a major thing, but it's, I don't know, just what you're taught when you talk about religious guilt, it has no power to me.
Yeah, I think that reflects, you know, what I grew up around and still hear from family members, which is basically a fearful sales pitch, you know, that if you don't behave, you're going to hell, and it makes. What?
How do they want you to behave?
Vote for Trump. well, you know, they've given up on that. no, it is, and this is my problem with a lot of mainstream religion, and it's why I think we even have a phenomenon called spiritual but not religious, is that mainstream church-going religion has become affiliated with all kinds of political and cultural agendas that are only loosely related to the personal spiritual search. So, you know, not too many decades ago, there would have been no difference in spiritual and religious. People wouldn't even, except to maybe theologians. But now this, just all by itself, this movement has grown up of people saying, yes, I'm spiritual, but not religious. In other words, I don't want to associate with that. And I think it's because usually it's people have been raised up in a religion which taught them a number of things to believe that are not necessarily spiritual in nature. You know, they're cultural and political.
Anyone else?
I was raised as a Unitarian, so I spend a fair amount of time trying to take ancient ideas that people had and make an attempt to translate it into modern equivalents. And it seems to me that my guess is that the original notion of original sin is that we're flawed. We're not perfect beings.
Right.
But that then there's connected to it in the recognition of that flawedness, imperfection, is the idea of worthiness or unworthiness and shame. And I'm trying to see the relation or difference between guilt as a responsibility, taking responsibility for our being flawed, and the shame that comes from feeling unworthy or an excessive sense of responsibility.
Right. I would say, you know, shame is sort of the social aspect of guilt. You'll sometimes hear people say that so-and-so is guilting me into this, but what they mean is they're shaming. They're trying to shame people into doing something. So if you get shamed, you may feel guilt. To me, that's the difference. Guilt is what you feel individually. Shame is what's projected on to you, you know.
Yes, I grew up in a very old-fashioned household, and guilt was absolutely necessary for faith. If you want to be saved or have faith, you must surrender. And in order to get you to a place where you're willing to surrender and take a leap of faith, you need to play down your natural ego and egocentricity. And for that, you need guilt. You need to be aware of your flawed nature, as David was saying. So it's a prerequisite. If you have too much ego and have no guilt, you can never surrender to faith. If you lower your ego, then you're willing, if you're willing to be saved, you're willing to make that leap. Because you see a need for it. Without guilt, you have no need,
right,
for faith.
And it's interesting, that brings up an interesting idea to me, is that a big part of the influence on the spiritual but not religious movement is Eastern religions, which I wouldn't say they entirely dispense with guilt, but they replace it more with the consciousness of error, you know, and of self-correction and self-improvement. And one of my favorite sayings of the meditation teacher, Stephen Levine, even though he got it from his teacher, was real meditation is just one insult after another. And what he meant by that is if you're really meditating, you're going to see your flaws and imperfections like all the time, right up in front of you constantly. But it's not a cause for guilt, as we think of it in the Western perspective. It's just like, oh, that's screwed up. I need to change that.
Doesn't Islam mean surrender?
Yep. I don't know. Does it? Oh, okay.
So does your evangelical sister appreciate that her brother is an evangelist?
I'm serious, actually.
It's interesting. We used to kind of connect on the issue of like that everyone needed a spiritual perspective. But she became increasingly, to me, increasingly radicalized and angry over the years, you know. And now she makes an equation between her concealed carry permit and her Christianity. Like, Jesus told me to do this. And, you know, this makes no sense to me. I have talked to my sister and brother-in-law without effect about, you know, alternative paths. I've told her blankly, I'm not afraid of going to hell since I've been there. And and it just, you know, I think you just have a mythology that you've chosen to believe that doesn't make any sense. And if I say that, she'll say, yes, but if you don't believe in Jesus Christ, you're going to hell.
But you're spreading your good news, which is what evangelical in one of the meanings is, to spread the good word or news.
Yeah, yeah.
So you both are doing the same thing.
Yes, yes. And
except you just carry your God outside.
So I want to ask the question, coming off your Levine quote, you're saying that you need guilt, and I'm going to counter-propose that what you need isn't guilt, it's an aspiration that can guide us. I mean, why does one sit in meditation?
Right. Yeah, it's the difference between, I would say, what I think of as guilt is sort of wallowing in that sense of error and not doing much about it except feeling bad. And I think that's what a lot of people have reacted against when they call themselves spiritual but not religious. So in every spiritual path or perspective, yeah, there's a recognition of error, something's gone wrong, something's not right here, we need to work on stuff. But it's the question of, you know, yeah, is that energy sort of interned and judgmental, or as you say, aspirational? Is it about changing something?
I am an ex-Catholic. I was taught that guilt is a way of controlling, really. And I had nightmares all my life as a child. And when I think about all of the abuses of priests, I think in the Catholic religion, it is a way of controlling people through their guilt. Hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's the widespread experience that has led to this movement called spiritual but not religious. And this has been going on longer than you might think. In 1988, Better Homes and Gardens, of all the periodicals, you might not expect to do it, did a survey on religion, spirituality, and the American family. So even in 1988, they were making a distinction between religion and spirituality. And it was a huge survey. They had 80,000 respondents. You know, on paper. This is pre-digital. And what they found, that even then, was that a very high proportion of people were saying that they turned to a spiritual practice or a personal spiritual advisor before they turned to their minister or to the standard teachers of their choice. And so this was very early. No one was saying spiritual but not religious then, but those were the roots, that even as far back as the 80s, this awareness was beginning to rise. And it's only, you know, accelerated since. And no one made this up. So far, I've researched it, and I've not found anyone who came up with this term. It just seemed to arise out of the culture.
It's shifting the mindfulness.
Yeah, 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 in Eastern terms. Okay, let's move on to trust. step to is gathering trust. The capacity for trust rests chiefly on one's own trustworthiness. It is far easier to find reasons to trust others when you have every reason to trust yourself. Thus, the key to gathering trust is one's own commitment to truthfulness and personal honor. A commitment necessarily leavened with compassion for human frailty and forgiveness of the human tendency to fail. Strengthening one's own honor and truthfulness in a world shot through with illusions and deceptions is the first faith-building step that is tinged with transcendence. To be trustworthy is to go against the grain of a cynical culture, and some would say against human nature itself. Thus, to extend trust from the foundation of personal honor is to foster a vision of a new human nature. My questions on this topic are, what or whom do you find it most difficult to trust? We can start with politicians or skip them. Do you think trust must be earned? In what circumstances would you extend trust on faith?
What an interesting question. And my answer to that is that the first person that I need to learn to trust is me. How can I trust anybody else unless I know and can speak from my own steady place?
Right.
Thank you for this topic, and I would say that I too find it most difficult at this point when I'm trying to make major changes to trust myself, you know, because of human frailty and habit.
Right.
And I think that under certain circumstances that I trust on faith, but I would replace those words with trust on love, in love, because I also see the failings of my partner, and I know in some ways a leopard doesn't change his spots, but on the other hand, I want to trust him because I know in love that he would want to be the better person he could be.
You know, that brings up a really interesting experience. I just have to mention, I used to attend the Unity Church in Marin. As many of you know, the Unitarians are on the far left fringe of the religious mainstream, and Unity is out there. And I was at this dinner of a bunch of people from the church, kind of reminiscing, getting together for the first time in a long time. And the subject of Donald Trump came up. And a teacher at Unity of Marin, who I greatly value, her name is Sharon Sherrard, she got everyone riled. Everyone was upset. They were talking about what's going on. And this wasn't even the most recent stuff. We were talking about 4 or 5 months ago. And somebody turned to Sharon and said, how do you deal with it? And she said, well, I have to love him. And you might as well have set off firecrackers all around the table. You know, and someone said, but to love him is to trust him. And she said, no, it isn't. She said, I trust him not to be trustworthy. She said, that's a different issue. But I love him because he's part of me. And everybody was on her case. And she just kept shaking her head and saying, nope, you gotta love him. You gotta love him. What do you think of that idea?
In theory.
Yeah, I wanted to say a word or two about the relation or the connection of the trust and community. I mentioned my Unitarian background, including being a member here for close to 40 years.
Wow.
And there are some people here I've now known for a few minutes, and a few people I've known for decades. And there is a sense of trust in community. Richard Stromer, a Unitarian, an educator, was speaking once in this pulpit or podium about the practice of religion in community. So there's the personal practice of religion and spirituality, but there's also this sense of community of,
right,
of doing it together.
Right, right. Yeah, that's. I do discuss that a little bit more in here. I didn't quote that part here, but here I am talking about trust as the inner foundation of how you go out and trust others. That and build that community, because if there's no trust within, you're going to have a very hard time. If there's no trust within, other people are not going to look trustworthy, I think.
Hi.
Hi.
Good progression here. The part about having to love him is part of that kind of like cultivating the inner cultivation and saying, okay, so what is really going to be useful for me? And that's this first part about having reason to trust myself. If I do the weeding that's going to make my life easier to live, It is so much easier for me to live my life if I'm loving myself and trusting myself and putting out love towards others. Now, it's really a cultivation practice. And when you talk about practice, I really like that, because a lot of the messages, I mean, I'm doing a personal theology in 2 weeks, and a lot of the messages have been, no, I'm not trustworthy, oh, I'm second best, I'm blah, 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 blah. And the just digging in the weeds all the time is building trust in myself. And that leads me to be able to trust other people. And this community part is part of what Mac was asking about with the guilt. And it's not so much the external rules about living in community, but the internal integrity that I can use with other human beings that I guess I would call trust, and being open to them coming back to me with the same kind of honesty and integrity.
Hi. I come from a Jewish tradition, and so my compass is a little different, I think. I don't believe that you have to forgive Donald Trump, just like I don't believe in forgiving Hitler, which came up in one of my chalice circles. What I believe in is, I do trust myself, but what I trust myself to do is to continue to try, continue to try to make things better, and accept the fact that I'm flawed. And I feel that way about my community in being in right relationship. So from that perspective, I don't feel good about laying down my reason which draws the line between things that are acceptable and things that I don't find acceptable. I don't find cruelty, for instance, acceptable. So in that sense, faith and surrender are an interesting duality to me, because I think, in fact, I am someone of faith, and I struggled for a long time, and then it seemed to me that I was gifted with grace, what I understand that to be. So that's all.
It's interesting how the trust issue goes back to the guilt issue also. I was raised as a Lutheran. My grandmother took me to Sunday school and church. She loved me. If it was good enough for her, it was good enough for me. So all sorts of stuff went in my head that I simply accepted without really thinking about. Today, I think I don't particularly believe or disbelieve most of that. I've thought about spiritual things. I generally trust myself as a decent person. But every once in a while, I feel some guilt if I'm sick or emotionally upset. And it's a very vague guilt that I think goes back to that childhood religious stuff. I don't know what I'm guilty about, but apparently there's some really basic flaw in there. And I was supposed to obey the authorities as the only way out, but what they wanted wasn't very clear either. So it's that vague guilt that's lurking in the background that interferes with trust sometimes. It keeps me from being otherwise rational, or, yeah, rational is a reasonable description.
So, I was raised in the Air Force. So I got that kind of religious background. And in the 60s, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were living on one of the targets, SAC Air Force Base. I grew up with very little faith or trust. And I sort of accidentally discovered it through my canoe club. And the canoe club was organized around the idea that there was somebody in the lead who kind of knew where they were going. And there was somebody in the back who made sure everybody got downstream. And that, we called them the sweep. The sweep was like the biggest eye-opener in my whole life in a spiritual way. Because there was a sense in which this was an organization, which I didn't trust at first, that was built around the idea that there's somebody who sort of knows where we're going, scatters the sand, you know, knows where we should scout. And then there's this other person in the back who's just making sure that everybody gets there. And that was, you know, that's where I get my trust, is that, you know, well, there's somebody back there.
It seems like that still comes from surrender, though. You have to surrender to have faith that they're really going to do their job.
Trust have to be blind? We talk about trust but verify. And obviously, if we are our own religious authority, we have to trust our gut to guide us. But is trust blind or not?
Well, that's why I asked the question, in what circumstances would you extend trust on faith? Or are there any, you know, what is the foundation of trust? The main idea I'm raising is self-trust is the foundation of all trust. But it doesn't necessarily cover all cases. You know, you may encounter a person or a situation where, if you're going to trust, you're going to be going at least partly on faith. And probably that's that might be hard to describe, but because it's going to be circumstantial. But that's a question that interests me. Blind is that's another kind of thing. I mean, that's the judicial ideal but it has a connotation of that to trust is to not see. I don't think that's necessarily true. It depends on how much you see and how you see it.
Driving on the freeway at 70 miles an hour
is an act of faith. Right. My name is Sue, and let me start with apologizing for my outburst telling you what a good sentence you had used some time ago. I'm a poet.
Do it again. I didn't hear that.
I'm a poet, and so I pay a lot of attention to word use. But when you ask about Trump, I am still in coming out of numbness shock as a Jew about Tree of Life Synagogue and the mass murder that happened there a week ago. And there is an old story that comes to mind of Jews in the shtetl asking their rabbi, since there is a blessing for so many things, what is the appropriate blessing for the czar? And as the story goes, the response was, may God bless and keep the czar far away from us.
Since you brought up the story of trusting Trump, I also read a very interesting article, and I think this refers back to someone who was speaking as a Jew in the back of the room, there was an article about how the people, I can't remember the name of the church, where they were all gunned down in a Bible reading, Jeremiah Church, where they all went up to Pittsburgh to join the synagogue in their grief and so forth. But the rabbi that they were interviewing was saying that some of the people from the church had actually forgiven the murderer. And I understand that in Jewish tradition that you can't forgive somebody if you're... It's only the person who's been harmed can forgive, and since they're dead, they can't do it, and you can't do it for them. And so, but the rabbi said, I wish I had their courage.
My other book here is called The Forgiveness Book. Years ago, it was published as a little book of forgiveness. So I've thought a great deal about this. And I remember years ago, there was a school shooting. This was a while ago, 10 or 15 years ago. Not a huge one. Two or three kids were killed. And I remember reading the newspaper that the next day, a group of Christian students led a forgiveness ritual. And I remember thinking, too soon. Like, way too soon. You know, not the next day. I think there's forgiveness is a capacity we all have, but it can't be rushed into and can't be just endorsed as a panacea, you know. There are reasons to approach it slowly, or you know, or place limits on it, you know, in this same way of developing trust, you know.
Patrick, we have just a little over 15 minutes left.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you're going to speak at all about your illness and
how that changed you.
I can. This was a long time ago. I was in my 30s, which was like last year. And I came down overnight with a very mysterious ailment. I thought I had the flu, but it lasted for 7 years. And I was eventually diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. At the time, that was a brand new diagnosis, and it wasn't even believed that men could get it. I happened to have the good fortune of having a physician who was an AIDS specialist. And so he did know about it, and he knew the difference between AIDS and chronic fatigue. And the way he described it was, you're not going to die. He said, you're going to wish you could. And it was, in many ways, a repeated series of deaths. Ego death, over and over again, over 7 years. And it was when I was initiated to my spiritual path. And my spiritual path was it basically had three phases or three influences. First among them was a teaching known as the Course in Miracles. I've written the only full history of the Course. I know everybody in the movement. I've been an active publisher in the field as well as a writer of two books in the field. Another branch that fed into it was Jungian depth psychology, which I studied independently in some depth. And the third major influence was the Enneagram system of personality. I had the good fortune to know Helen Palmer, who's the chief teacher of one of the schools based here in Berkeley. And so this was a combination of spiritual influences that I sort of put together in my own head. And together, they kind of led me through the process of surrender and forgiveness. It's why I ended up writing a book about forgiveness first, after the illness. And it was the classic, you know, I look back now and I can recognize a classic dark night of the soul, spiritual initiation, you know, and it wasn't over quickly. Now, in some ways I feel fortunate in that it was over in 7 years. I've known people with chronic fatigue syndrome going 15, 20, 25 years. For me...
Do you attribute that, that you did get over it at all to the spiritual quest?
Absolutely. To me, it was my spiritual crisis. It happened to have that name. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't do every medical thing you can imagine. I lived here in Berkeley at the time, and so I saw doctors, and I had crystals put around me, and, you know, the whole schmear. But I used to speak to groups of chronic fatigue sufferers. And I'd always get a little backlash when I would say that I began to recover when I began to first recognize my anger. And it was a global anger at my family, at my history, at the world. Recognize my anger and then learn how to release it. The Course in Miracles, by the way, that's what it's about. It is about the recognition of anger, really, and releasing it. And it's often mistaken as kind of an affirmative path. Classically, it's actually known as a via negativa or negative path. It's about recognizing the darkness. And I was, you know, taken through that step by step. Anyway, when I would speak to these groups and say, I began to heal when I began releasing anger, I'd get some backlash, and people would say, well, you're just saying it's all in our heads, and which is what doctors are telling us. It's just all in your heads. And I would say, yes, it's all in your head, it's all in your body, it's all in your mind, it's all in your spirit, it's all over you. And you have to work on all of it at once. And it's like And it literally is like, yeah, it's 100% in your head and 100% in your body and 100% in your spirit. It's that kind of crisis. And I think that is the crisis with many autoimmune diseases, which by definition, autoimmune is the body attacking itself. many autoimmune diseases have a spiritual root or foundation. So yeah, that illness was, you know, central to everything I did later. Earlier, in my 20s, I'd been an investigative reporter, and my worldview was that the world was really screwed up and somebody was doing something wrong, and I was going to find out who it was and blame them. Not surprisingly, I fit in very well at the erstwhile San Francisco Bay Guardian, which is where I was my investigative boot camp. And I became disillusioned with that worldview when one time I did a very successful story, a very successful investigative piece. By successful, I mean it pissed everybody off. Calls were coming into the office. Sources were telling me they would never speak to me again. At the time, the office of Senator Alan Cranston got on my case. Everybody was pissed off. And I remember the publisher, Bruce Brugman, coming up, clapping me on the shoulder and saying, "Good job, Patrick." And I realized then, this is not for me. I can't. I love the idea of investigation, and I still love the tenets of good investigative reporting, but it seemed to be about generating anger, you know. So after that illness, I returned to journalism, but I became a senior writer for a yoga journal. Whole different approach.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean to distract you from the questions, but I just thought that would be an interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's take on one more, and then and see how far we get with it. Yeah. So our finish time is when?
Quarter till.
Oh, okay. Okay, patience is a short one. Patience is deciding in favor of attention rather than tension. Attending to the inner part of ourselves that knows timelessness, we can wait in the world of time and balance our hurried sense of self-interest with a timeless knowledge that all will be well, even when the all swallows us, as it inevitably will. Patience, then, is also humility, a surrender to the transcendent. Patience is the rhythm of faith. My questions are, what have you been most impatient about in life? What are you still waiting for? And what have you learned from the experience of waiting on the most important things? And I'll say one thing about that. Later in this section of the book, I talk about my illness and how it taught me the value of waiting on nothing, which is, again, at the heart of the dark night of the soul, where you're in a complete void, the abyss. You can't do anything. There's nothing to want. Everything is hopeless. And there you sit until you change. That's one kind of patience, but there are others.
First of all, I'm going to apologize for my phone going off. But secondly, I'm a writer. In fact, I just recently published a novel, and it's the first of a 7-book series of science fiction. But I also am I also want to write self-help books for LGBTQ children, teenagers. And because I remember what it was like for me, and I want to write a book for them. And I was wondering, when you write a self-help book that's spiritually based, what advice could you give me?
Well, I'd have to save that for elsewhere. I mean, yeah. I consult with people regularly, and I have information about that.
Maybe you can talk to him a little bit after the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody have any?
To answer the questions, I'm sorry, I seem to be. Does anybody else want to talk who hasn't? basically, in answering these questions, I'd say what I've been most impatient about in life is someone else getting it.
Is what?
Someone else getting it. Anyway, and I'm still waiting for transcendence, the big nirvana. And one thing I remember someone saying in terms of, like, I do Tai Chi, and I've been doing it for over 40 years, but and Qigong, and I remember being bored with the movements of the Qigong, and I said that to someone, and they said, well, if you're bored, you're not really getting it.
Okay. Yeah, I formulated something here as a result of all this. I said, trust in imperfection creates tension. Because an imperfection means other human beings and ourselves. And so we can't deliver peace. So trust in a perfect transcendent God produces peace and patience and release of guilt. Anyway, that's my conclusion, because I found personally the whole thing of just surrendering to God as a creator is what brought me the peace and strength. To me, any other kind of trust is not going to deliver.
Right.
It's not going to deliver that. And that's my own personal experience.
Right. And in a sense, in a non-religious sense, God is your own highest capacity. Highest capacity. In other words, if you're putting it non-religiously, you know, because you're talking about something perfect and trustworthy, rather than the old idea of God as you know, sometimes a nice guy, sometimes punishing, sometimes judgmental, you know. Not necessarily something you'd want to place your faith in.
Sorry, wait. Lois's turn. This is probably going to be our last question, so...
Okay.
I'm still stuck back on your lady who says you have to love in order to trust. And I that resonates with me. Maybe because I'm guiltier than other people in here. But because I'm flawed, I know the other person is going to be flawed. And somebody has got to start the trust ball going. So in what circumstance would I be willing to trust? And does a trust have to be earned? No, somebody has to start the ball going. So if you recognize that the other person is flawed, but you take a chance on them anyway, it's not so much the results that you're going for. You're doing this not because you want a certain result. You're doing this because it makes life more abundance. You're operating out of abundance. You don't have a small amount of energy, and if you give it to someone who's unworthy, your whole life is ruined. If you come from a sense of an abundance, that's where people can maybe not forgive Trump, but at least have patience, wait until his tantrum is totally over, and maybe then he would be open to change.
Well, what's interesting to me about that is that Sharon, my friend and teacher, was saying, what she was basically challenging this group was saying, don't trust him or forgive him, but love him. And that raised the question, well, what does that mean? You know, everyone was like shaking their heads. You know, if you cannot trust or forgive, how do you love? Is that even possible? And Sharon just kept saying, you got to do it, you got to do it. And I didn't know, my response to that was mixed, you know. And I was kind of, but I was impressed by her certainty that you can love without trust or forgiveness. I don't know.
Because you love life. Because
yeah.
you see the humanity, even in the worst flawed, sinful.
Okay. American society is known to have a fast pace. When I think of it, the words are gotta do it, have to do it. And then, in contrast, in the chalice circle, we sit in silence and we listen to each other. How much internal talk is going on? We're not communicating with each other. And so there's this pace inside of us that just doesn't connect with other people. We've got to get this done.
Is that it?
Yeah. You want to say anything just to wrap it up? Or?
Oh, I'll just tell you a little bit about the books. I'm selling each of my books for $15 a piece. On one of those, you get a nickel back. The other one is about a dollar off, or two for $25, and we can take either cash or credit card on my phone. I also have a sign-up list for my website newsletter. Some information about spiritual coaching and consulting that I do. And finally, my services as a agent and literary consultant.
Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
And there's another agent here, but she doesn't want to be identified. So.
Thank you very much for coming, Patrick.
Thanks.